This is WNHN LP 94.7 FM in Concord, streaming live at WNHNFM.org. You are listening to State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're here from the American Friends Service Committee and actually from our COVID-era Zoom studio. This show is a companion piece to our weekly State House Watch newsletter.
And since we are pre-recording this, we won't be taking any calls this week.
Arnie, we never take any phone calls.
Oh, good point, Maggie. Anyway, our newsletter does go out on Fridays. You can subscribe to it by going to our website at afsc.org/NH and look for the subscribe to State House Watch button. It is pretty simple. And while you're there, check out information about the Arnie Alpert Action Fund and a online YouTube concert that we're having this coming Saturday evening at 8 p.m. featuring Joyce Anderson live from her barn in York, Maine.
She's been doing these concerts on Fridays at 8 p.m. And they really are lovely. I tuned in for a little bit the other day. And so Joyce is a huge fan of yours, Arnie, and she is really delighted to sing her Songs of Peace for Mother's Day this year in support of the Arnie Alpert Action Fund.
All right, good. So we'll see you there on Saturday. Well, things got very busy on Friday afternoon, Maggie, as we were putting the weekly newsletter together. News was actually breaking out all over, which people who read the newsletter on Friday were able to get a taste of. But let's go back to what some of those key developments were.
Sure. Where do you want to start? Probably the biggest news with the stay-at-home 2.0, the governor's press conference with the state epidemiologist. Should we start there?
Let's start there. And we were grateful for Susan Bruce, our colleague, to record the press conference, and we pulled out some clips. The news conference started with Dr. Benjamin Chan, who is the state epidemiologist.
We are announcing an additional 164 people who have tested positive for COVID-19. That brings the total in New Hampshire to 2,310. Of these individuals, 270, which is an additional 8 individuals from what we reported yesterday, have required hospitalization at some point in their illness. And unfortunately, there are 9 additional deaths related to COVID-19 that we are reporting today, bringing the total of people who have died from COVID-19 in New Hampshire to 81. All of these new people who have passed away from COVID-19 were associated with long-term care or nursing facilities.
So Arnie, with the numbers that Dr. Chan shared, did he characterize them as a spike, as a plateau? How do we understand these?
Well, they're watching the trends is really what they're watching, Maggie. So they're watching the daily figures, but they're also keeping an eye on how it changes from day to day and week to week. So here's a little bit more of his summary of how they're assessing the situation now.
I think these numbers point to and reflect the difficulty that New Hampshire and many other states around the country are having in terms of controlling the transmission of COVID-19 once it gains a foothold in our close living and congregate living settings like long-term care and nursing facilities. Even as we talk and plan about how to reopen different segments of society in the coming weeks, it still remains critically important for us to protect those who are most vulnerable in our communities, and specifically older adults and those with chronic medical conditions, which put them at increased risk of adverse complications from COVID-19, need to still remain at home as much as possible and only go out for the essentials. And we need to do our collective job in terms of helping these individuals, these populations, social distance so that we can protect them.
Well, certainly as I'm listening to that particular segment, I'm also thinking about the difficulty of maintaining physical distance or achieving physical distance in jails and prisons. Did Dr. Chan mention that those environments as well?
No, that did not come up. There was one question that came up later on in the news conference about the prison system, but that is certainly not something that Dr. Chan was addressing directly, and we will talk about that a little bit later on the show today. But let's finish up here with Dr. Chan's summary of what they're seeing, and then we'll get into how the governor is interpreting it all.
I want to just summarize by saying that our social distancing efforts have been having an effect. There is some early signals of decreasing community level transmission, but we still encourage people to stay at home as much as possible, leaving only for essentials. We want people to, when they're out, still keep a safe distance of at least 6 feet from people at all times, practice good hand hygiene, and when in public places, especially if social distancing may be difficult, please wear at a minimum a cloth face covering to protect others from the possibility of asymptomatic or presymptomatic transmission.
So with that in mind, Governor Sununu launched into a lengthy presentation about what he's calling stay-at-home 2.0.
So the people of New Hampshire, as Dr. Chan alluded to, have taken this epidemic incredibly seriously, and we cannot thank them enough. Everyone has played a significant part in flattening the curve and slowing the spread of COVID-19. And unfortunately, while we are not through it yet, we know we still have a ways to go. Today we're here to announce our amended stay-at-home order, what we're calling Stay-at-Home 2.0, where we will flex out additional areas across the state, modify our existing order to give Granite Staters more flexibility in their daily lives. This modified stay-at-home order will be in effect through May 31st, 2020.
And Arnie, what happens at that point? What happens on after May 31st? Did he explain?
No, but I think we'll get more information over the course of the month, perhaps. They'll have to start to see how things are going. But basically what they're talking about now is kind of a phased approach to reopening the state a little bit, and he kept coming back to saying that this is a data-driven process that they're following.
But we are taking steps to reopen our economy in a smart, phased approach that's supported by facts, science, and data.
The presentation was full of lots of slides and graphs and charts, which we obviously can't show you today on the radio. But I want to mention that they kept talking about the blue line that they said was trending downward that has to do with the number of cases of people who are being found to be positive after being tested.
If you look at the blue line coming down around that same time when the orange line starts to peak up, you see the blue line, a general downward trend starting about 10 or 14 days ago. And that is the percent positive of COVID cases per number of cases that we do. So in other words, for any particular day, even though we might have a large number of positives, like today, we had over 160 positives today, but we're doing over 1,200 tests. So overall, we have a downward trend in the number of positive cases of COVID on a percentage basis across the state.
Arnie, was there a discussion about the increased availability of tests in New Hampshire? That has seemed like a really important capacity to grow, not just here in New Hampshire, but nationwide.
It's a great question, Maggie. I'm not sure that that was an emphasis of this news conference. It has certainly come up repeatedly in news conferences with Governor Sununu and with Dr. Chan. They seem to be saying that their emphasis is on testing people who are showing any type of symptoms. And they're feeling like if they can keep up with testing those people, then they're going to be able to stay on top of the trends. The main point of the governor's news conference on Friday was to outline this new set of phased in or flex was his most popular word of his news conference. So in addition to what he's calling universal guidelines, and those are for the businesses that were already deemed essential and that were open, there are now separate sets of guidelines and separate dates for these different sectors, including golf courses and campgrounds and parks and hair salons and barbershops and retail stores and restaurants, each with a different date by which they are allowed to be open, and different very specific sets of what they called guidelines under which they are supposed to open. A lot of this, Maggie, has been developed through the work of the governor's Reopen New Hampshire Task Force, which I have to say is largely made up of and has been listening largely to representatives of the different business sectors in the economy. So trade associations for restaurants and lodging, trade associations for golf courses, listening to cosmetologists. As far as I can tell, they are not doing much of actually listening to the workers who are on the front line in all of these settings and who are the ones who are going to be running the risk of getting exposed to the virus. That was not mentioned much in the governor's presentation. It was not brought up much in questions from reporters, and I fear it's not adequately reflected in the guidelines themselves. One of the things I'm wondering about, Maggie, the governor called these guidelines, but if you actually read the print and what it says about operating restaurants or operating retail stores or operating businesses that are covered under the universal guidelines, it's full of lots of shall and must requirement language, not should and advised kinds of things. And what we really don't know is whether or how the state is actually going to assure that these guidelines are being followed in order to protect workers and protect consumers in any of these establishments. Here's what the governor said when asked about how they could count on golf courses and other recreational facilities to actually enforce the guidelines that he is promulgating.
It's really up to the facility to make sure that they're adhering to the rules of the guidelines. So again, we don't have stay-at-home police that patrol the state.
Was there any talk of fines?
No. Again, I mean, his emergency orders, he's talked about the various rules being enforceable by Health and Human Services with help from state law enforcement, but those are not specified in the new sets of stay-at-home 2.0 guidelines, which were released on Friday, at least not that I was able to detect. The governor has put forward some, I think, some very strong, very sweeping, what looked to me like mandates that I can't imagine that the business community is going to be entirely comfortable with in the sort of live free or die, hands-off spirit. So that when they say things like, you shall take the temperature of every worker in your establishment on a daily basis, that's the type of language that New Hampshire's business community has traditionally recoiled at. Now, I don't know how that is going to be seen as this goes forward. Another thing that was interesting is that there was a question about whether workers who had been laid off because their businesses or their employers had been shut down, and if they didn't feel comfortable coming back to work, could they continue to be unemployed? Here's what the governor said about that.
Yeah, right now we're not changing the rules around unemployment. And if a worker wants to remain in their unemployment phase because there's a health risk to them, that they can remain doing that.
And what I'm not clear on is whether that was just in the governor's press conference or whether in some ways assurances to workers that they don't have to go to work and that they can't be fired for refusing to go back to work if they believe that it would be harmful to their health to do so. What the guidelines say is if you're sick, you need to stay home, but I'm not clear right now on whether there are enforceable protections for workers who refuse to go to work in hazardous circumstances.
Well, that makes me curious about what are the mechanisms by which regular people would know about this in an ongoing way. Do people have to go to the Employment Security website? Do they have to read these various declarations? Have there been public service announcements on WMUR that are targeted toward New Hampshire community members with questions about these kinds of things?
I don't know the answer, Maggie, but why don't we try to get some answers to those questions so that our listeners, at least on State House Watch, can learn what is necessary to protect workers. So we'll keep tuned on that.
One curiosity I have, Arnie, was there any mention of summer camps, or is that a decision for a future date?
I don't believe that there were any special rules on summer camps. I know that there's been discussion within that sector of the economy with them trying to figure out what they're going to do this summer. And right now, I don't know where that is trending.
The governor was asked, when are things going to get back to normal? And this is what he said.
When will New Hampshire return to normal? Normal being what it looked like back, let's say, March 1st, or a long time. It's going to be a long time.
That's an important message to be sending.
That is. Lots of talk about flexing, lots of talk about how this is a data-driven process that they're operating under, lots of conversation about the input that he has been getting from the different business sectors about their own areas of specialty, and lots of talk, Maggie, about the danger lurking just a mile south of the border where northeastern Massachusetts right now is one of the national centers with the highest level of COVID-19 outbreak taking place. So the governor is very concerned about that and has his eyes on the situation in Massachusetts, understanding that obviously people do travel back and forth and that maintaining social distance means helping people to not be exposed to people who might be carrying the virus.
Wow. Well, many thanks to Susan Bruce for gathering all of this audio for our listeners. And we will certainly be keeping people posted. This has become a central area of focus for us, particularly as the legislative activity has been dramatically reduced. Although let's talk about what is going on there.
What's going on, Maggie, is that in the House side, they're very slowly getting back to business. Last week, the House Finance Committee held its first Zoom-based executive session with votes taking place. Next week, there's another committee that's going to have an executive session. The Senate does not appear to be going back into operation yet, but they're clearly testing out ways in which it's possible for members to meet and to conduct the state's business without coming into physical contact with each other, and while maintaining the ability for members of the public to listen in to what's going on, which is an essential element of the state's right to know laws, that our government is not supposed to be operating in secret. It's supposed to be operating in the light of day, and they are trying to figure out how to do that. But meanwhile, Maggie, there is a power struggle which is still unfolding, in which the members of the Executive Council and members of the legislature are recoiling a bit against the governor's emergency declaration, which he believes gives him, in effect, unilateral authority to accept the federal recovery and relief funds and decide how those are going to get spent through his gopher group. Last Friday, the Democratic members of the Legislative Fiscal Committee went back to Superior Court saying that the governor is violating the law and violating the Constitution through this unilateral authority, and that they, in fact, do have standing in order to make this court challenge. So we will keep an eye on that.
Can we expect a prompt response from Superior Court?
Well, Judge Anderson certainly ruled rather promptly last time. This is a motion for reconsideration going back to the same court. I'm not that kind of lawyer. In fact, I'm not any kind of lawyer, Maggie, as you know. So I don't know fully how quickly this will move. But I think in general, it does seem, as you can describe in a moment when we talk about the Stratford County Jail, that the judges are doing their best to try to give timely process and timely consideration of these fast-moving things where people's health is so much at risk. There's also going to be an Executive Council meeting this week, and members of the Executive Council, again, who in normal times, they get to oversee the governor's decisions on how the state spends money. They've been largely cut out. The governor has responded to a letter from counselors Volinsky and Pignatelli asking for information about where he wants to spend the money, and he has at least said that he will provide them information prior to this week's council meeting. Counselor Volinsky said basically, well, that's a good start. So we're going to have to keep our eye on that as well in the coming week.
Can I ask a question about the legislature? In this effort to find ways to continue conducting their business with physical distancing and other requirements in this COVID-19 moment, is there a bipartisan spirit of problem solving in terms of addressing the obstacles to conducting their meetings electronically, virtually? Or is there resistance to forward motion that tends to fall along party lines?
That's a great question, Maggie, and I don't think I'm in a good enough position right now to comment on that. I think that the institutional weight of moving forward is something that legislators in both parties feel. I think they take their jobs and their role seriously. But of course, when you end up with a conflict between leaders of the House and Senate and the Republican governor, there's always going to be at least a tinge of partisanship coming forward in these times. So we saw, for example, the motion to reconsider came only from the Democratic members of the Fiscal Committee, not from the entire membership of the Fiscal Committee. And if the full legislature was in session, then you might see votes on the floor of the House and Senate with regard to this. But since they're not actually meeting, they can't take up that type of business to represent the interest of the whole body, which certainly members believe is a co-equal branch of government, co-equal to the governor.
Right. And this will be precedent setting. One would think that that legislators from both political parties would be wanting to preserve the authority of their branch of government.
Now, Maggie, the one other thing that was going on over around the State House, I don't think it was actually at the State House, because of course these meetings are all taking place like the way we're recording this radio show over a phone, over Zoom, other types of electronic mechanisms. Secretary of State William Gardner, under pressure from voting rights advocates, I think, has now appointed a select committee to advise him on how to make better access of absentee balloting at a time in which many voters would find it unsafe to go to their city clerk's office even to register to vote, let alone going to crowded polling places on election day. So his select committee had its first meeting this past week.
And his select committee includes advocates for access to voting?
Well, his select committee includes some very experienced people such as Brad Cook, who chairs the Ballot Law Commission, people who are or have been local city and town clerks, some legislators. It does not include people that you or I would recognize as advocates for substantial voting reform. It doesn't include people of color or people with disabilities who have long been concerned about voting as a civil rights issue. And it does not include people who are advocating a comprehensive approach to making ballot access something that is more generally available. And that is certainly what groups like the Coalition for Open Democracy, groups like the Kent Street Coalition, and others brought in statements to the Secretary of State's Select Committee when they met last week. So we'll keep people posted on that agenda as it goes forward as well. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord. Maggie Fogarty, while all of this was going on around the State House on Friday, you were actually listening in on a federal court session. Tell us about that.
Well, Arnie, the ACLU of New Hampshire and four private law firms have brought a class action lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And so they had an evidentiary hearing in front of Judge McCafferty at 10 a.m. on Friday. It started at 10 a.m. It ran until 6:15 p.m. The primary evidence was testimony by the Stafford County Corrections Superintendent Chris Brackett, who described the considerable effort underway in an ongoing way at the jail to implement protocols to try to reduce as much as possible the risk of infection by COVID-19. And he explained how the facility responds to the possibilities of exposure, to the arrival of new people, whether they are ICE detainees or inmates at the facility, how they check staff temperatures, et cetera, every day. So a very thorough range of steps that they take there. And then the judge heard from three individuals, immigrants in ICE custody at the facility, and their testimony showed that the application of these protocols was uneven, was not thorough, had a lot of gaps, and simply couldn't be fully lived out in the confines of that jail environment. So by the end of the hearing, Judge McCafferty gave an oral ruling that she wanted to start immediately with bail hearings today on Monday, prioritizing those who are most medically vulnerable to infection and death by COVID-19. So that is what's scheduled to start today at 11 a.m. in the U.S. District Court. And we shall see. We're eager for not only the outcomes of those bail hearings, as many as can happen, but also for her written ruling, which is expected, I believe, at some point early this week.
Are you optimistic that a substantial number of immigrants are going to be released from the county jail?
Well, I hope so. I may be hearing what I want to hear, but the judge was certainly seemed to be recognizing that the entire community at the jail, employees and imprisoned people, will benefit by creating a whole lot more space for physical distancing so that people can have much more room to spread out in the various units and even in the sleeping quarters. So she just seemed to see that as very important, rightly so. And so that doesn't get accomplished by releasing one person or two people. That would point to the need to release, we're certainly hoping, everyone there in civil custody, since people in civil detention do not need to be there for public safety.
Maggie, are you aware of whether the similar cases that are going on in federal courts in many other states have a bearing on how the judge will decide on this?
Yes, absolutely. She indicated, making reference to other cases, and certainly the lawyers for the petitioners were pointing to several cases, would create a likely favorable outcome for medically vulnerable individuals in custody at the facility. So that seemed to support her willingness to give that oral ruling at the end of the day on Friday.
Well, that's good to hear about. Well, on Sunday, there was another demonstration, another car rally outside the county jail in Dover. I was there, and a little later in the show, we'll give you a little listen to what it sounded like there. We'll also have coming up on today's show an interview with Barbara Rocky, a longtime occupational safety activist from Philadelphia, talking about the measures that are necessary for workers to protect themselves in the workplace. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a musical break.
Now working in this mill is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. But when I have the time and the proper equipment, I can do my job safely each day. Everybody tells me that they're sticklers for safety. I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die. Now I don't want your chemicals clouding my brain. I want to keep all of my fingers and toes. I want to hear those tears that fall through my ears when my working days come to a close. I'm not saying that you don't care. I'm not saying that you don't try. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't. Office on a telephone that's oh so approved. Go on and tell me how much you've been spending on safety. Pardon me, but I'm not moved. I'm not saying that you don't care. I'm not saying that you don't try. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
May take you out to Coos Bay, Oregon, and if they do, be sure to look up Harry Stamper, the longshoreman who wrote this song when the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, first passed in 1970. Harry hoped it had stopped the annual slaughter of American workers, and it helped until 1980 when something mysterious and evil happened in Washington, D.C. Suddenly, those OSHA guys were nowhere to be found, and going to work can be more hazardous than ever to your health. Don't be one of the 58,000 American workers who are going to die this year from work-related injuries and illness. If your boss tells you to do something dangerous at work, there's only one of two things you can do. You can tell your boss what Harry Stamper told his boss, which you'll have to ask Harry about that. I can't tell you here. Or take a tip from Nancy Reagan and just say no.
No!
You know, we sat still through 8 years as Reagan watched OSHA brought down to his knees. Saw lots of union busting and watched our plants rusting while our jobs were shipped overseas. But if Bush thinks we'll settle for more of the same, we're here to tell him that he better not try. Because we just come to work here, we don't come to die. You know, Mary Harris Jones was a top organizer, and her words still inspire me today. And if she took a look at our working conditions, well, I think I know what she would say. If you're talking about a worker's memorial day, mourn the dead while they're ringing the bell. But just remember Mother Jones when it comes to the living, and you know we gotta fight like
This is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert. We've just observed International Workers' Day over the weekend. And of course, with this pandemic crisis, we are thinking a great deal about the peril that workers are in all over the country and all over the world. So we're glad to be joined today by Barbara Rocky from Philadelphia, who is a longtime activist in the world of workplace health and safety. Barbara, welcome to State House Watch.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Could you just say a word or two about how you got involved in organizing for worker safety?
Well, actually, as a young woman, I was an office worker, and I got involved in organizing at my workplace, which was a university. And health and safety, actually, even then, was an issue. We were successful, and I eventually went on to become an organizer with the United Auto Workers Union, and health and safety became one of the leading issues in most of our organizing campaigns. So when I decided to get off the road and take an early retirement from the UAW, I was very lucky to be able to move my career into doing health and safety through Philiposh, which is one of the oldest, what's known as COSH groups in the country, Committees on Occupational Safety and Health, that work with all workers, whether they're union or not, to advance their safety and health on the job. And I held that job up until 2 years ago, where I'm retired now and able to do everything.
All right. Well, congratulations on retirement. I'm looking forward to that myself, Barbara. A lot of times when we talk about COSH, there's a confusion with OSHA, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And of course, that's a federal agency whose job is to actually look out for the interests of workers. How would you assess the role that OSHA is playing right now in this pandemic crisis?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is the 50th anniversary of the founding of OSHA. And so it's had a long time to get this right. And we work closely with the OSHA staff in the Philadelphia area, who do an amazing job. They're career health and safety people. But on a federal level, whoever's the current president, of course, appoints the respective heads of the agency. And we're seeing the result of that, which is not good. So in this pandemic, first, they were totally silent, even though they had the authority to issue emergency standards. They had the authority to do a lot of things to respond to the uniqueness of the situation, and instead have now joined with the CDC to issue voluntary guidelines for the most vulnerable workers, which it's then up to the employer as to whether to implement them or not. It's crazy. It's not what OSHA is about. It's not the OSHA I knew, but that's what we're dealing with now.
Wow. So what do you advise to workers who find themselves, whether we're talking about manufacturing or agricultural work or healthcare or retail or all these other sectors, where workers are in danger of being exposed to the virus on a daily basis? What can they do?
I mean, I think always the root of any successful activity is organizing. And so there is a big difference as to whether or not they have a union or not. So the workers that are lucky enough to be in a union have a contract which will have language in it that addresses generally their rights to safety and health, which would include using the grievance procedure, and their rights to go outside of the grievance procedure. They also have staff with their national unions who can give them a lot of assistance. Of course, even in this situation, the pandemic is so huge and so different than anything we've ever experienced that it's not entirely clear what would be the right reaction in every situation. If they're non-union, however, it's very clear that employers basically are taking the position that they show up to work and follow the rules as they're laid out, or they are terminated, and they're not recognizing their right not to come to work, or they won't at least collect unemployment benefits if they refuse to go to work. We're tragically seeing that a lot in Pennsylvania with the people working in the meatpacking industry. But in general, if you feel your conditions are unsafe, one, you want to network with your coworkers. You want to reach out to professionals who in the area who might be able to assist you, which may include contacting an attorney. You need to do your research, contact a COSH group if it's in the area. and also stand up for yourself in terms of filing complaints with the employer and filing complaints with OSHA. Even though OSHA is very weak right now, it's still you want to go on the record to describe the unsafe conditions that you're being subjected to and why you're fearing for your safety.
Barbara, I understand your experience is largely in the Philadelphia area, but I'm curious if you would just generally advise people to contact their state Department of Labor in a situation where they thought there was unsafe conditions?
I don't think there's any downside to contacting any agency that, you know, might be assistance. Even some cities may have departments of labor for the city as well as the state that might be of some assistance. And actually, when I was with United Auto Workers Union, I actually worked in almost every state in the country, including the South. And we were always having to deal with the differences in geographic areas. But in spite of what the situation is with OSHA right now, they should also definitely contact their area OSHA office, whichever one might be the closest to them, and file a complaint. And again, I want to make the distinction. Often the OSHA career staff who work in those offices who are not political appointments, they're professionals in that job, in the area they work in, are not into the political part of this, and they can be very important resources to reach out to, separate from what's happening with the national lack of direction and policy.
Well, at the state level here in New Hampshire, one of the bills that we've been tracking and supporting is one that would give increasing authority to the New Hampshire Department of Labor to develop and enforce OSHA-like standards for public sector workers in New Hampshire who are left out of the protections from the federal law. Now, of course, with the legislature in an induced coma right now, that legislation is stuck. But when they come to life again, we'll get back to trying to move that forward. Barbara Rocky, you mentioned that Philip Posh is about to launch a new project. We're recording this on Sunday, but apparently tomorrow is when the announcement is going to take place, on Monday.
Well, or the finalization of launching it will be finalized, and sometime this coming week it'll actually go out in the mail. But we want to reach out to labor organizations, workers' rights groups, advocacy groups of various kinds, immigrant rights groups, et cetera, throughout the city to make them aware that we stand ready to help advise them, guide them. We also want to be collecting information throughout the city, throughout the greater Philadelphia region, including the materials that they're developing themselves, so that that sharing can happen, where one group can read somebody else's material and get ideas. And, you know, we'll just be launching, and it's going to take a while to make it happen, but we think people are eager to have those kinds of resources more available to them, building on each other's ideas and successes.
Well, great. That's great to hear about. How can people contact Philip Posh to find out more about that?
Well, the current director of Philip Posh, her name is Nicole Fuller. Philip Posh, you can, its number is 215-386-7000. However, they're not working at the office. So if you go to the Philip Posh webpage and leave a message there.
We'll look that up and we'll put that on the website for this show. And I also want to remind our listeners that they can contact New Hampshire COSH at nhcosh.org and reach out to them for information and advice if you think that your workplace is unsafe. Well, Barbara Rocky, thank you so much for being with us on State House Watch, and best wishes to you and to everybody at Philip Posh.
Thank you. And thank you for covering this issue. It's so important and we really appreciate it.
Of the story of a nurse named Nancy and the way that she's been ignored. She grabbed her stethoscope and scrubs, kissed her husband and family, went to work on the med-surg floor. But did she ever return? No, she never returned, and her fate is still unlearned. Poor old Nancy, she may work forever in the med-surg unit. She's the nurse who never returned. Nancy worked all night from 7 to 7, never letting her attend. morning sun deceived her. There was no one to relieve her. Nancy couldn't get off her shift. But did she ever return? No, she never returned. That her fate is still unlearned. Poor old Nancy, she may work forever in the med-surg unit. She's the nurse who never returned. Nancy worked all day giving medicines and comfort, but she never could get a break. She took care of 7 patients who had many complications and somehow had to stay awake. But did she ever return? No, she never returned. And her fate is still unlearned. She may work forever, forever in the med-surg unit. She's the nurse who never returned. Nancy told her boss, hey, we need more nurses to care for the patients here. He said, we think the pace is fine if our profits pass the baseline, which was $50 million just last year. Does she read tax returns? Yes, she reads their returns, and she's seen the profits they earned. Shame and scandal, though her boss would never treat her fair. She fought him. She's a nurse who reads tax returns. Now, you hardworking nurses, don't you think it's a scandal that the boss has gotta be so cheap? Stay with our picket line until our contract has been signed, so Nancy can go home and sleep. Or else she'll never return, no, she'll never return, and her fate will be unlearned. Like poor old Charlie, she may work forever in the med-surg unit. She's the nurse who never returned. She's the nurse who never returned.
Ava Castillo, we've been having demonstrations on May Day just about every year. What's different this year?
Well, we have COVID-19, and since we already have these rallies every Sunday, and it's pretty much the same people that go to the May Day rally, really, you know, New Hampshire, people in social justice, we cross paths in everything. So today, this is our May Day rally, and in support of immigrants, in support of workers, in support of vulnerable people, and to ask Stratford County Jail to release the prisoners there.
I'm gonna pull around to that stop sign down there and come up and pull off to the side. So we're gonna kind of line up, and then we're gonna head over. You take a left at this light here. It's about an 8 or 9 minute drive. We will try and stay together as a convoy. It's not always easy, so I would recommend having in your GPS if you don't know how to get there, how to get to the Stratford County Corrections Center. And we are going to do a couple loops in front. Put your hazards on. Don't beep in front of the prison. And then there's a big parking lot in the courthouse that is like right next to the jail. We're all going to park in there afterwards. If you feel safe getting out of your car and maintaining social distance, we'll sing a few songs and have a few parting words and calls to action. We all good?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. Let's go.
Thank you so much, man, for coming today. I appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for coming today, my friend.
Thank you for coming.
Gracias, Eva. I'm going to put some of this on a radio show tomorrow.
I just want to express my appreciation for everybody that has come here today. You know, they have better things to do on a Sunday, especially through a pandemic, but they're choosing to come here and lift up the spirits of everybody detained over there. You know, the better things are ahead of us, and then I think just by showing this little bit of solidarity, we're gonna get there sometime.
In Action, New Hampshire. Let's give it up.
We've been pushing a petition out that is demanding that the governor step up and push back and demand the release of these detainees. Hope should not be a death sentence. Coming to this country as an asylum seeker should not be a death sentence.
This is Laura Aronson. I'm one of the organizers for this event, and I think we have a very high degree of energy and commitment. It was wonderful that the inmates could hear us and see us, and we know that they were responding, and we're hoping to give them encouragement and hope at this difficult time. We remember the slogan, "Never Again," because from the Holocaust. I'm speaking here as a Jew, and the organization was founded by Jews nationally. We were always taught as children growing up to never forget, to say never again. But a lot of us, most of us probably believe that it's not just for Jews, it's for anybody who's suffering persecution. We can't let that happen. It's a burden on our conscience. But I think that everybody who's involved just understands what never again means. I think the turnout was very good. The energy is good. And we're looking forward to doing this next Saturday. It has to be moved to a Saturday next week, and we would hope that people will come out and join us.
There is a song called Woke Up This Morning. So it goes like this. Woke up this morning with my mind.
Woke up this morning with my mind. Say on justice. So woke up this morning with my mind. Said on justice, so woke up this morning with my mind. Said on justice, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Next Saturday, 1 o'clock. Okay, but make sure you stay on top of the Facebook event and stay looped in.
Got a word for today for the radio.
Oh, wow. Keep fighting. We got to keep fighting for justice.
Right. See ya.
I've got a poem for you.
All right.
I'm sure you know this. Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace. For those of us in prison, circle for release.
Sounds like a song.
Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace. For all of us imprisoned, circle for release. Circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace, for all of us imprisoned. Circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for all of us imprisoned, circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace, for all of us imprisoned, circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole.
When I was young and full of dreams, my whole life in front of me, things aren't always what they seem. Some dreams don't come true. The future's so bright, so everyone said, I made more money than my papa ever did. It was the answer for which I'd prayed. when the industry comes to town. I married a girl from Poche Bridge. We raised the family of Cajun kids. Nobody did better than we did. Things can always change. My pop had been a trapper living hand to mouth. When I made sharp form and I had it all figured out, I thank God each and every day when the industry comes to town. Sunset on Louisiana, sun going down on the promised land. I've given you everything I can. I got nothing left to lose. My sister lost a baby premature, and my papa got that sickness that ain't got no cure. What they told us down at the plant, but we cannot be sure. My boy went to college down in Baton Rouge. He came back talking about the old bayou. Sure, the fish don't bite like they used to since the industry come to town. Sunset on Louisiana, sun going down on the promised land. I've given you everything I can. I got nothing left.
Watch with me, Maggie Fogarty, and my co-host Arnie Alpert on WNHN LP.
Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all of our past shows, as well as Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, My Neighbor's Garage, and The Dave Scott Show. Join us again next week, and remember, there's a bright side somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere, and there's more love somewhere, and there's more peace somewhere. I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. People got a good job somewhere. Got a lot of good friends somewhere. Got a little suitcase. Got a little family over on the bright side.